This is an ABC podcast.
Ali'i, aloha kākou, hafa day and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, coming up on the show, alarm bells ringing after Nauru government announces a $1 billion investment proposal signed by a Chinese company. Former First Lady of PNG calls on Australia to step up its support for the Pacific to ensure regional health security. And in the world of rugby union, calls for decision makers to scrap Tier 1, Tier 2 ranking systems. All that and more coming up. I'm your host, Aggie Dubois, and I say thank you to Mus. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with the Australia-Nauru Treaty. Signed earlier in the year, has now come under scrutiny from the Australian Parliament's Joint Standing Committee on Treaties. That deal is designed to enhance bilateral cooperation and enable mutual agreement and consultation on Nauru's partnerships. So the recent announcement by the Nauru government of a $1 billion investment proposal signed with a little-known Chinese company has already set alarm bells ringing. And as a result, the ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgett, says although Australia is yet to ratify the treaty, MPs on the Joint Committee are already putting it to the test.
According to Australian officials, ever since Nauru's parliament signed off on this back in February, Nauru has been walking the talk, basically. It's been essentially acting like the treaty is now in place, even though Australia's parliament hasn't got around yet to actually ratifying it. But both sides seem happy to just say, yes, the treaty's been signed, so we're now going to try and enforce it. And in that sense, this deal with this rather mysterious Chinese entity is emerging as an interesting test case for exactly what Australia can and potentially cannot do in terms of putting any sort of restraints on the decisions made by Nauru's leaders.
So do we know any more then about this deal? Is it becoming less mysterious or perhaps more so?
If anything, Richard, more mysterious. What really became clear over the course of this hearing is that Australian officials effectively know very little more about this deal or this company than you or I do, or in fact anyone who has read the 15 lines or so that the Nauru government put out in its press release earlier this month. So in that sense, we know very little at all. We know that the company in question, the CDRRC, has very little in the way of any sort of online paper trail. The ABC has been trying to find any evidence that it even exists, and so far have found only a couple of companies whose names notionally come close to matching it, and there's very little public information available on them. What was interesting is that so far Australian officials, at least according to what they told the committee, have gone through a similar search and have also basically come up blank. They have found very little evidence about this company and say that it has almost no presence on the internet. So we are no clearer about exactly what this company is or exactly what it does. And we're also no clearer about exactly what's being contemplated other than that statement that Nauru's government put out a few weeks ago, which basically is little more than a long list of various sectors that this company is allegedly interested in investing in. That spans from maritime infrastructure to the phosphate industry to tourism and a whole list of others. And the fact that, according to Nauru's government, they are contemplating a truly massive investment using the figure of $1 billion Australian, a staggering sum for a country like Nauru, which, as you know, has a population of only 12,000 or so. So at this point, we have very little hard information about exactly what's being contemplated. One small nugget of information we did get today from officials is that at this stage, it is only a, quote, proposal, and that Nauru's cabinet has not yet considered, let alone endorsed it. So one thing that Australian officials are clear to make very, very apparent here is even though this has been signed, at least by Nauru's foreign minister and a representative of this company, nothing has yet been formally agreed to by the government of Nauru, which means Australia can make inquiries about what's being contemplated. It has done that. But at this stage, there's nothing concrete in front of the cabinet which Australia can either veto or really scrutinise.
You say Australia can make inquiries, and the Assistant Minister for the Pacific Island Affairs, Senator Anita Green, she was in Nauru, what, just last week or the week before? So presumably she must have made those inquiries, but perhaps didn't get any answers. I mean, Nauru seem very keen at the moment to publicise what they're up to without offering any further explanation.
To be frank, Nauru has given zero information beyond that one statement that I mentioned, and so far has not replied to any of the ABC's requests for information. I'm not sure how many other media outlets have also applied for information or who have sent questions to Nauru, but if any of them have got any answers back, they haven't published anything on it. And what seemed interesting is that Australian officials who've also asked Nauru for information have not yet had any luck. They told this committee that they've requested a copy of this so-called investment proposal. They said that Nauru had not agreed to hand over a copy, but then they also said that they hadn't ruled out handing it over in the future. So they suggested that Nauru was still considering Australia's request to take a look at this document, so in order to get a better idea of what's being contemplated. But so far, I think it's accurate to say that Nauru's government has behaved with a high degree of secrecy over this agreement, and we may not get any clarity anytime soon. As officials point out, Nauru's going to an election pretty soon, most likely around November, and Australian officials say that they don't believe that we'll see much activity on this, and certainly nothing formally agreed to until after that election. So that's at the earliest at the very end of this year, perhaps at the beginning of next year. We may see a quote, scoping visit by this rather mysterious company that's been publicly flagged by Nauru. It may happen in October, but it sounds like even that hasn't yet been officially confirmed. So just vast uncertainty still at this point.
And that's the ABC's Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgetts, on the line from Parliament House in Canberra, and he was speaking to Richard Hewitt. Now, former First Lady of PNG and Chair of the Global Fund, Lady Ross Marotta, is in Canberra this week to release a report calling on Australia to step up its support for our Pacific neighbours to ensure regional health security. It comes as the Pacific has been ravaged by escalating health crises with surging outbreaks of HIV, tuberculosis and dengue fever. Now, Lady Ross Marotta joins me this morning to discuss this. With that, I say good morning and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Aggie. Good morning.
Yeah, I appreciate your time this morning. Look, the Pacific region, right, for the last two decades have been making great progress in fighting diseases, like I've said earlier, HIV and TB. But what sort of happened that we are seeing this resurgence?
There's been a terrible resurgence in both Papua New Guinea and Fiji in HIV. We did really well in the early days and had largely got control of the epidemic, and very much thanks to Australian support in the early days of the epidemic. But in the last 10 years, the situation has changed. In PNG, for example, in 2024, there were 11,000 new cases of HIV, and that's double the number of 10 years earlier. The same in Fiji, which had largely got control of its epidemic. There's been a huge rise in cases, 4 every day, which for a country the size of Fiji is huge. And the problem is that not many of those people, only about 20%, are on antiretroviral treatment. Mm. So the disease is spreading rampantly. I hate to say this, but Australia gave fantastic support to the HIV response in the Pacific in the early days, particularly in Papua New Guinea. And that was withdrawn. The HIV funding stopped virtually overnight in 2016. And one can't wonder whether there's some correlation between that loss of support when the government wasn't able to step in, particularly to fund all the church and organizations and NGOs who are active in the HIV fight. And we see the results today.
Mm. And Lady Marotta, with the report, what does it actually tell us about how severe the impact is of these diseases spreading across the region?
This report is just an overview of the Global Fund's activities in the Indo-Pacific region. This is a replenishment year for the Global Fund. Every 3 years, we seek funds for the next 3 years. And we're on a replenishment campaign, our eighth replenishment campaign at the moment. So we prepared this report specifically for people in this region, focusing on this region, to show what the Global Fund has been able to do and what the ongoing challenges are. So it's a short report. It's not a long report, very much aimed at what the Global Fund is doing.
So then when we look at, you know, like the local health services coping with the influx of patients presenting with these diseases, how are they actually coping?
Well, they're not coping. It's such a huge increase in HIV. And if we take Papua New Guinea, for example, the health system is absolutely overwhelmed already. So when you lose the services of NGOs and the churches, it just compounds the situation. And there are particular problems with both HIV and TB because there's so much stigma and discrimination associated with the diseases. And that continues. It persists to this day. So it's often very difficult for patients to access services, either for fear of stigma and discrimination or just the in Papua New Guinea particularly, the sheer problem of distance to services.
So with your organisation, you know, the Global Fund, how much, you know, do they play in addressing these issues? Because one, we know that, you know, Australia is probably the biggest aid partner to much of the Pacific, but why is it important for Australia to step up and, you know, its funding towards your organisation, the Global Fund?
The return on investment to Australia for its investment in the Global Fund is huge. For every $1 that Australia, US dollar that Australia contributes to the Global Fund, we're spending $13.6 in the region. So it's a very efficient way for Australia to be giving money to countries in the region. And the results of the Global Fund are clear. Since we were established in 2002, we've spent around $580 million in the Pacific, just the Pacific, not the Indo-Pacific. That money has saved 213,000 lives. It's an extremely effective organisation. And I would hope that Australia would not only continue to support, but increase its support to the Global Fund.
Can I ask then, is this campaign for funds off the back of, you know, uncertainty about the Global Fund not receiving money from the US, you know, which historically
No, we are receiving money from the US. The US continues to be a very important donor to the Global Fund.
Okay. Well, thank you for clarifying that. Look, if you are just listening to Pacific Beat, where my guest is former PNG First Lady Chair of the Global Fund, Lady Ross Marotta, we're talking about the health crises unfolding in the Pacific and, of course, Australia's role in sharing storing up regional health security. So let's look at weak health systems in the Pacific, because we know that those pose risks, right? Not only locally, but for regional stability and security more broadly. Your thoughts?
Well, diseases don't have passports. They don't know borders. So it's not only the right thing for Australia to do to help these countries tackle these diseases, but it's actually in Australia's own self-interest too. The proximity of Australia to these countries and the degree of movement between them is a threat to Australia, a health security threat.
So then with regional security, we know that's front of mind in the Pacific at the moment. Can I ask, you know, with the Pacific Island Forum coming up shortly, where defence and climate change are often talked about, is there a gap then when it comes to health being spoken about in the security sense?
I think there is in this region. We don't look at the security aspects of health issues nearly enough. COVID should have taught us that one can't do that. One has to bear in mind the health security aspects of health issues, and I'm not sure we've learnt the lesson. And I think it would be great if the Pacific Alliance Forum took on some of these social issues that do have security implications.
Well, Lady Rasmorota, we do want to say thank you very much for joining us this morning on the show. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome, Aggie.
Thank you. That is Lady Rasmorota, Chair of the Global Fund and former First Lady of PNG. And welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie DuBois, and joining me in the studio this morning is our producer, Carl Evans. How are you doing this morning?
I'm well, thank you, Aggie. I always feel like Tuesday is the start of the week just because Mondays are such a blur after the weekend.
Yeah, well, here we are a little bit more clear-eyed for your Tuesday. And, of course, you are bringing us our headlines around from the region. First one here is Marshall Islands president has voiced opposition to the Solomon Islands' decision to bar development partners from PIF. What does this mean?
Yeah, that's right. So we were waiting for some leaders to potentially speak out about this, and Hilda Heine has done so, saying Jeremiah Minnelli's decision will hurt the Pacific Island region and urged him to reconsider this approach and explore a more balanced path forward. So this was reported by the Marshall Islands Journal, who broke the story yesterday. The letter that she wrote herself was dated back on August 8, and in it she said the current path forward just doesn't uphold the forum's legacy of inclusivity and could have the unintended consequence of distancing partners at what's a pivotal time in the region. Yeah. She then went a step further and said PIF is the only avenue where Pacific leaders engage collectively with development partners about urgent priorities, and to delay these dialogues at such a critical time where the global attention and funding and cooperation are essential in the Pacific, it would be a huge missed opportunity.
Well, I'm wondering, has Manele responded though?
Not that I could see. However, her concerns were echoed by the Palau leader, Sarangal Whips Jr. He also called it a missed opportunity, reminding Manele that it wasn't a Solomon Islands event, but a forum event. And it's worth pointing out as well that both Palau and the Marshall Islands do hold diplomatic ties with Taiwan, yes, who's obviously at the centre of this decision, and hence why they've obviously got skin in the game in this matter.
Alrighty. Okay, let's head to Guam now. The brown tree snake is again proving itself to be one of the Pacific's most harmful invasive species. Gosh, what has it done this time?
Yeah, I couldn't look past this one, Aggie, to be honest. So the Pacific Daily News has reported that brown tree snakes have caused around 150 power outages a year over the past 4 years in Guam, and have already caused 50 in 2025. And if you're wondering how, so basically they're attracted to the warmth of electrical equipment. So they're constantly crawling up power lines and entering electrical substations, which essentially causes the equipment to short circuit and ultimately fail. So much so that in June this year, so just a couple of months ago, it had more brown tree snake related power outages than any other month with 14, and a similar figure in July as well. So that's in addition to the brown tree snake obviously eating all the native birds and native species, including wiping out the Guam kingfisher. Proving once again that they are an absolute pest to be reckoned with.
Yeah. Carl, is there a way, though, that the authorities could, like, stop the power problem?
No, is the short answer, Aggie. they're doing their best. So authorities are doing everything they can. They're trying to trim vegetation near poles, install barriers and traps near substations. Mm-hmm. But while it's all been helpful, it's not reducing the number of outages. And last month, the U.S. Department of Agriculture have actually started night surveys so they can get a better insight of snake behavior at night. So I guess they're crawling in there under the hours of darkness, but not that you'd probably see them anyway. But I just hope that the whoever the Sparkies and electrical experts out there are getting paid a lot of money for the job they do.
Absolutely. Okay. Now let's head to sport, because there's an announcement that's pending for clubs who will take part in a new professional OFC professional soccer league. Is that correct?
Yes, that is right. So this is the new OFC Pro League, which has been touted for quite some time now, and I can't believe it's this close. But basically, the OFC president, Lambert Multok, says that clubs that will make up this new competition will be announced this Friday. So 13 clubs have applied to join the inaugural comp. However, only 8 are going to be selected to actually play in it. Okay. The process of this application survey went out way back in January last year, with 24 clubs initially expressing interest. That then was cut to 13, and they include four clubs from New Zealand, two each from Fiji and Papua New Guinea and Australia, and one club each from the Solomon Islands, Tahiti and Vanuatu.
Wow.
So five clubs will be cut, and it'll be very interesting to see where those cuts come from. Personally, I hope they come from New Zealand and Australia, just because it is a Pacific competition, I don't want to see Australia and New Zealand monopolise this, especially when, you know, they've kind of got their own competitions, including the A-League, which New Zealand play in. So,
Let's see. Well, Kyle, as always, thank you so much for bringing our news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Thank you, Aggie.
InZane Rugby League on ABC Radio Australia. Hosted by ABC Sport commentator Zane Bojack, InZane Rugby League is a weekly look at the lighter side of rugby league, featuring game insights, latest news and interviews with rugby league legends and from around the edges. So close to the action, you can almost taste the turf. InZane Rugby League, Tuesday nights at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
Minaka Vakalevu, welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie the Bowl. Now this Friday, Samoans will head to the polls to cast their vote at this year's snap election. With six political parties, over 180 candidates all vying for seats in Parliament. Now whoever wins could alter the course of the country's political landscape. Well, joining us live on the line to give us an overall look at the world of politics in Samoa is political analyst Lingboiva Sherelle Jackson. With that, I say, Malo Resoifun, welcome to the show.
Hello, Faegi. Malo Resoifun, Lingema.
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us this morning. You know, as we dive straight into this, I mean, polling is literally less than a week away. Lingboiva, why does this election matter?
This election is probably one of the first truly democratic elections that we see, because there's now three very popular and viable parties that will be running. You know, often in the past, there's one clear majority winner or two, you know, strong parties. This will be the first where we can see three really strong parties head to the polls together. So it'll be very significant in that we're testing those parameters of democracy by having this, like, fair go by three parties in this election.
Yeah, and let's talk about that. I mean, people are saying the challenge for the snap election is maybe how the government will be formed, right? Like, what are the possibilities if we look whether or not it's a majority win, a minority? Are we looking at independents and smaller parties? What is your take on this?
I mean, at the moment, based on, you know, conversations and analysis that we've been doing in the background, this may just end up being a coalition party, because there are still, you know, there's still very strong loyalties by each party, by, you know, by citizens to each party. So it is very much up in the air at the moment, with different strengths for each leader and each party. So it may just end up being a coalition government at the end of the day.
And any possibility of what those coalitions look like, Lungi? What do you think?
At this point, no one can say what that would look like, because it is the first time that we're experiencing this in Samoa, where you have three equally strong leaders heading to the polls together. Mm. Tuila Epa has come back strong. HRPP's manifesto is strong. They are organized. They're ready to hit this election. Laauli's following has continued to increase and strong locally and in the diaspora. And Fiamea is still the caretaker prime minister, and she has a very loyal following as well. So it will, you know, only time will tell how this will actually eventuate.
And the only reason I sort of asked, Lingboiva, about, you know, possible coalitions, and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, there was reports that FAST had sort of ruled out, right, partnering with either two main parties. Do you think they're still going to take that stance?
All the actions that Laauli have taken have been somewhat unpredictable. The leader of FAST, you know, at first, when FAST came to be and he sought the, you know, allegiance of Fiamea, we thought that was going to be until the end for the FAST party. But he changed and things switched up, and, you know, he started, you know, utilizing some Trump playbook actions. So although he has said that, it doesn't necessarily mean that he will be close to to those possibilities. Okay. Because he has demonstrated in the past that he has changed his mind and he has changed allegiances where it suited him.
Mm. I want to switch to then, of course, you know, this whole snap election with, you know, FMS split from FAS after failing to pass its budget. Now she's got this newly created, you know, Samoa Uniting Party. Do you think her new party has somehow maybe, or her moves that she's made has somehow exacerbated an already unstable political state of affairs?
I think it was a natural move for her, given that she is leading the subgroup of FAST members. I think what it does is it offers an opportunity for Samoa to really speak at the next elections on who they favor, because there will be, you know, it will be clear who they favor, at least as a leader. What it has done is that it has offered another avenue for those in FAS to show their support for FIME. So there's no instability, but there is uncertainty.
Okay, well, what about numbers? You know, the numbers game, and I talk about this in regards to women more so within the House. I believe women hold six seats. What if fewer than six are elected? What happens then?
Well, we'll go back to, you know, to the 10%, I understand, which was the issue that we had before. That will be interesting because that was really what happened in the last elections, which led to the whole, you know, crisis that continued for well over a month.
Mm. Then what is the importance of gender equality then when you look at this snap election coming up this Friday? Do you think people are willing and are still wanting to have, you know, Fiamea be in power?
To be honest with you, I don't think gender has been so much an issue or has been on the front of mind for many voters. And it's certainly not an issue that has been at the forefront of the upcoming elections. What has happened is that there has been some negative responses to, you know, to gender equality in parliament because of the way that Fiamea's government has, you know, has ended up. At the end of the day, this government has dissolved before the end of its term. And, you know, unfortunately, it is under the leadership of a woman. And so those who are naturally inclined to make sexist remarks or give this a gender dimension have used this opportunity to really blame the fact that the government is led by a woman, which has led to this. Mm. You know, but gender, Samoa is very much a personality-based political system. Mm. So if you look at the numbers and the manifesto and all of that, at the end of the day, a lot of Samoans make decisions on who they vote for based on the personality, your family lineage, and how you benefit from that, you know, from that party. So it is, like I said, it's going to be very interesting because we're going to have this mixed dynamic of how people vote in Samoa, whether it's back to the allegiances of their family, the personality-based politics, or they will vote for the party that they want to lead.
And let's talk about that because, you know, when they go to cast their vote on Friday, we are looking at what people's priorities are. What do you think any of these parties are really thinking about cost of living, the fact that they've dealt with blackouts and even just this political turmoil? What do you think are the priorities for Samoa right now?
I mean, the cost of living for Samoa has really increased and people in, you know, rural areas, you know, that includes my family and Savai, you know, they're really struggling. And especially those who are no longer relying on the land, but relying on their family members who work. That's a key priority for Samoa is affordability of, you know, of life and people affording basic goods, you know, and just increasing their quality of life. Another one is the infrastructure is a major, you know, as you mentioned, there's been blackouts. There's also like road issues and things like that. Mm. So there's also those very basic government services that also need attention. And then a big issue always that we come back to is the influx of Chinese businesses and also just Chinese presence in Samoa taking away from the livelihoods of Samoan people. So those are key issues.
When we look back at, 2021, or the last elections, there was a massive influence of the diaspora. Come this Friday, how do you expect people to with the diaspora? Are they still influencing Samoa?
That was a very interesting thing about the last elections, as you said, just this very apparent and very loud presence of diaspora influencing their families at home. It did have an influence on what happened at the end, right? FAST was very active on social media. Mm-hmm. They had a large following in the diaspora, and at the end of the day, they won, right? Now, all three parties have the same, and HRPP has only increased their visibility on social media and support in the diaspora as well over that time. The new thing here is that even though there was an intention for diaspora to vote, for people like myself to be able to vote from overseas, that was never implemented. One has to actually go back to fly to Samoa, register, and then fly back to vote. So you still, at this moment in time, diaspora still cannot vote unless you're actually physically present there. Mm, mm. And the other shift here is that people can now vote and, from where they reside. So before, you used to have to travel to your constituent where you were registered to then vote or to a special booth in town. So this also just changes the dynamics of the number of voters in urban society, and also the sway of voting depending on where everyone will be voting. So it's going to be very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
But at the end of the day, diaspora has had some influence. Mm. But whether or not this will be reflected in the numbers at the at the polling booths, that's something for us to see.
Well, yeah, I just wanted to ask that because come Friday, do you actually expect people to really exercise their right to vote?
Certainly. I think this election, more so than ever before, there will be this huge desire and huge turnout to vote, mainly because there's so much vested interest in the outcome of this election. And I do know that there are there's quite a few diaspora from Samoans from Australia, New Zealand, and the US who have traveled back to vote, who will travel back to vote.
Well, it will be a definite wait and see as to what happens on Friday. But just want to say whaftaitele lava langi poiva for joining us this morning.
Whaftaitele, have a good day.
Thank you. That is, of course, political analyst langi poiva Sherelle Jackson here on Pacific Beat. Now to the world of sport now. The chief executive of the Tonga Rugby Union is calling on the game's decision makers to scrap the Tier 1, Tier 2 ranking system. Aisia Aholele says it's out of date and denies teams like the Agaretahi the chance to play regular matches against the leading nations. The CEO has made his call at a time when it's probably safe to say that the whole country is still buzzing after Tonga's win over Samoa in the Pacific Nations Cup at the weekend, a result that has set the team firmly on course for the 2027 Rugby World Cup in Australia.
It's a massive, massive step. It's not over, but we were planning this game all along because once you get past the first stage of Samoa, then you're pretty much looking good for the rest of the tournament and the qualification for the World Cup. So it was always the first step that we had to make sure that we get past and win. We have achieved that, and it's just made things much easier for us for the rest of the tournament. Others have to play and win and lose, but we're in a good place at the moment.
So you have Fiji next up. Clearly, you would love to record a win over them as well. But from Samoa's point of view, the following week, they have to beat Fiji, don't they? Otherwise, they'll end up in the fifth, sixth playoff. And whoever loses that doesn't qualify for the World Cup. They have to go down another pathway. They're not out of it altogether, but it gets harder.
Yes, yes. It'll be harder for them. It's what we were trying to avoid from the beginning. And, for us, I'm getting on the fair that first part. But look, I mean, Samoa, they can beat anyone on their day, even Fiji. But it's tough. It'll be tough for them to play Fiji, but they'll be playing on neutral territory. So it could be anybody's game, I guess, because it's not in Samoa. But I think they'll rise to the occasion. They'll give it their best shot against Fiji. But just thankful that we're in a good place. And it pretty much for us is just to make sure that we play well against Fiji. And I'm sure the boys will listen to the game.
That one win, though, that is behind you now over Manu Samoa, I mean, in terms of drawing positive attention to what the Tonga Rugby Union is up to, and in terms of pricking up the ears of sponsors, for example, I mean, it surely can't do any harm.
Yeah, it'll be a real, it's a real positive, you know, especially when you're going to approach sponsorship and have approached sponsorship or sponsors. It gives you a lift, and, you know, it gives you that backing of, you know, that people are paying attention, and it has eyes on our team, and sponsors want that eyes on that brand of the karakahi and Tonga rugby. So it only bears well, you know, it's just for us to actually find those sponsors or them find us and find a way for them to help Tonga rugby and our teams.
Of course, one of the difficulties that Tonga has had, and indeed Samoa for that matter, in between World Cups is getting games against Tier 1 opposition. Now, it's not official yet, but it seems 99.9% certain that it will happen, that Fiji are about to be given Tier 1 status. You're up against them this coming weekend. Is Tier 1 status a realistic possibility for Tonga down the track, or do you think you'll have to settle for being Tier 2 for the foreseeable future?
I think, to be honest, you know, I think that tiered thing is ancient. I think it should just go away. Quality of play from Tier 1 to Tier 2 is really narrowed. Teams like Fiji now, you know, beating Tier 1 nations, they've been Tier 2 for a long time. You got Georgia, they're beating Tier 1 nations, you know. I don't know why they're still Tier 2 nations. As soon as we close that gap up and Tier 2 play Tier 1, doesn't matter who, it'll be better for rugby. I don't really mind who we play, Tier 2 or Tier 1, because I think the quality of some of the Tier 2 nations are already up there with the best of the Tier 1 nations are.
And I presume if they were to get rid of it, it might result in a more even spread of finance, mightn't it? Because isn't finance dependent on where you're ranked?
Yeah, exactly. It does help, you know, when you play a high-ranked team. But for us, it's playing more international games. It doesn't matter the quality of Tier 1 or Tier 2, because, as I said, the gap has closed a lot. But the more you play oppositions or better oppositions, you're certainly going to lift. I think Italy have already been playing a while against the best in the term in the Tier 1 nations, and same with Argentina. And look where they are now, beating the All Blacks and South Africa and Australia every other year. Likewise with Italy and the teams that were sort of at the bottom of the Tier 1 rankings. They're coming up really, really well. And for us, we just want to play more games so that, you know, our level of competition comes up.
And that's Aisia Aholele, Chief Executive of the Tonga Rugby Union, on the line from Nuku'alofa. He was talking to Richard Hewitt. And now, 2 years ago, wildfires devastated the town of Lahaina in Hawaii. Since then, recovery efforts have been concerted, but much of the community remains displaced and without a home. And as Whenau Whanua reports, there's uncertainty about the future, and the trauma of the disaster continues to haunt those who survived it.
Those are the sounds of a paroaut, a traditional Hawaiian commemoration custom in which people swim together into the ocean to pay respect to those who have passed on. They're honoring the memory of the 100 people who passed away in the 2023 Lahaina wildfires. It was a traumatic event. All of Lahaina's 12,000 residents were displaced, and memories of that day continue to affect them.
We're gonna do nothing for her.
What the f***?
Just go. Go, people, go. Beat the horn down.
Oh, my God, bro.
Sometimes I can't watch the news because, like, some of those cries that you hear in Gaza, they're like the same noises that I heard down there.
Benny Reinick was nearly killed by the fires after he found himself trapped inside the town. The fires cut off both ends of the road he was on. With nowhere to go, his only escape was the ocean. Reinick is heralded for helping free elderly people escape the fires, carrying two women on his back.
There's practically no way I can explain how hot it was there and the gust of wind and what it feels like to have iPhone-sized embers fall on your neck and in your back, and you know, you have to put that out. You know, there's smoke and ash that's falling on us. My hair is on fire at times. I gotta like put it back in the water and dap it and whatnot.
But 2 years on, Reinick says he and thousands of others are yet to recover financially from the disaster. He says most rely on grants and donations from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA. That's the government agency in charge of assisting the people of Lahaina, helping them to get back on their feet. But he says the uncertainty of the financial assistance has resulted in many of his neighbors deciding not to return to Lahaina.
Me and thousands of other Lahaina residents are so far behind and so stuck with everything that comes with rebuilding your life that we're basically on this month-to-month lease grant of sort from FEMA. And it's the most unassuring thing you can ever experience. It's just tomorrow they can just be gone, and we can't afford to live here, right? There's no more places to rent. We're basically being encouraged to just move on, go to the mainland, somewhere that's cheaper, abandon your family history.
Homes and houses have been rebuilt in Lahaina, but many are still living in temporary accommodation. Billions have been allocated to assist them, but community leaders say more is needed.
The recovery is going slow. Not a lot of homes have been rebuilt, and most of the fire victims were renters, and thousands are still displaced from Lahaina, many off island or even out of Hawaii.
DeAndre Makakoa is one of the organizers of Lahaina Strong, an NGO established after the disaster to advocate for the rights and needs of the community. Mr. Makakoa says many are still yet to be moved out of temporary accommodation.
I do believe that they're trying their best, but so far it has been inadequate. For a lot of people, the insurance payout didn't even cover the cost of the rebuild. And especially when it took, a lot of people were having to continuously pay for their mortgage while they were paying rent on their temporary home.
For Hawaii's Governor Josh Green, maintaining financial support from the U.S. government is a major concern. He says there's a real danger that U.S. President Donald Trump could cut funds to FEMA.
The people in Maui particularly really suffered it, you know, as a result of what happened with the disaster. You know, we're more focused right now on whether or not there will be cuts to FEMA.
For Benny Reinick, leaving Lahaina is out of the question, and he holds on to hope the Lahaina community will recover most of its population.
It's as simple as this. It's just give us all the tools that are necessary to rebuild our lives and watch us do it. It's as simple as that. But we're not given all the tools, right? They're paying mortgages 2 years in that are increasing and paying rent on top of that and getting the rights to be approved to rebuild. There's a line for that, and that takes months. All these things that are just, it's a compound interest of unnecessary bureaucracy, because I want to be optimistic. It gives you a sense of hope, but there's this dark cloud behind that hope. I can't confidently say that we'll see the same Lahaina that once was. However, if there was one community that can fight long enough and can endure long enough, there's one community that I know of that's here. And that's the people of Lahaina.
And that was Benny Reinick, a survivor of the Lahaina wildfires. Now, globally, 700 million people are food insecure, meaning they don't have access to enough safe and nutritious food. In the Pacific, despite positive developments, countries are facing escalating threats from climate change with frequent extreme weather, sea level rises and resource scarcity. Reporter Lucy Cooper takes a look into how climate change is impacting food production in the Pacific and what practical solutions are and should be implemented.
In universities across the world, alarm bells are ringing.
We're all globally experiencing a food crisis, probably a food crisis like no other in history.
Glenn Denning is a professor of practice at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. And for people like him who are studying this crisis, the stats are scary.
Our food prices are about 50% higher than they were, 60% higher than they were about 20 years ago, in real terms, right? So that creates a crisis situation.
He explains that if a family, community or country doesn't have access to safe and nutritious food, it can mean long-term health problems, increased hunger and reduce productivity, problems that can burden healthcare systems and overwhelm a country's economy, a reality that the Pacific is facing right now.
Rising sea levels has a long-term effect, but short-term effects of cyclones, for example, can really impact food availability. And when food becomes unavailable, people get upset. People get angry. When prices rise, as they are now, people get angry. And that's not good for political stability.
Climate change influences weather patterns, causing heat waves, heavy rainfall, droughts, and it's making food production a heck of a lot more difficult. So in the Pacific, food security will only worsen as climate change exacerbates it. But farming and growing food is also contributing to the problem. According to the World Bank, the global food system is responsible for about a third of greenhouse gas emissions, and it's the number one source of methane and biodiversity loss. It makes finding a path forward even more difficult.
There's scope for doing more. We need to sit down and work out concretely what can be done.
Globally, a renewed push for food security is underway. 153 Nobel and World Food Prize laureates have come together calling for bold agricultural research to combat hunger and the climate crisis.
Many of the countries have been using their traditional systems of agriculture to address some of the climate change impacts. And climate change impacts are now occurring at a faster rate than before, some of the systems are not suitable for doing in the Pacific.
That's Graham Sem, a professor of geography at the University of Papua New Guinea. He says a lack of infrastructure to support climate-resilient agriculture, like suitable drainage systems and inadequate storage facilities to preserve food, is limiting progress. But introducing measures which are known to work, like growing a variety of crops and offering up training and information sessions to farmers, would prove beneficial to the Pacific.
Climate smart agriculture is slowly taking a foothold in the Pacific Island countries when they work towards helping safeguard their production and distribution of food and food systems.
In the Cook Islands, Silani Taeria is a research officer and data analyst with the Tupuna Vai Marama Research Centre. She's been working on a project looking at how farmers are adapting their growing practices in response to climate change.
We found out that out of all the weather changes that they've experienced, so increased rainfall, temperature, extreme weather events, and like an increase of pests and diseases in the country as well, we found out that growers were more likely to adapt their growing practices in response to droughts because we've been having an increase of droughts recently. And our water has been getting low as well.
Farmers in the Cook Islands are on the front line of facing the impacts of climate change. But Mr. Area says to achieve the best results, it's all about the language which researchers use.
Although a lot of our growers understand that climate change has its issues, there is a chunk of our growers that either, and these are the more older ones, that either don't believe that climate change is a real thing, or they just don't believe that it's an issue that they have to worry about because they plant by using traditional methods. So this is why we chose to go with changes in weather, because when we ask them that, then they're able to tell us, yes, this seasonal pattern is different compared to 10 years ago.
So where is the pathway to climate resilience in the Pacific? Professor Glenn Denning said part of the solution is working to Australia's and the Pacific's unique strengths.
We have lots of solutions. We have lots of opportunities to turn that around to transform the food system. And Australia is particularly well positioned to do that because of its own long history of undertaking agriculture in pretty hostile, difficult environments, and also having very strong research systems in the country, first-class universities, research institutions, and the like.
An example of this is the work which Dr. Leanne Webb undertakes. As the CSIRO science lead for the Pacific, she looks at climate projects, working on long-term projections to years like 2100. Right now, Dr. Webb is currently working on a project in Vanuatu, which covers five sectors: agriculture, fisheries, tourism, water and infrastructure.
It's known as Van Kirup. It was actually a massive project that was undertaken over a few years, and we were part of that, doing the climate projections section of that project. And it was aiming to build technical capacity and deliver information and tools through the application of climate information into these five target development sectors. We undertook lots of case studies. So for agriculture, for example, we did four different case studies looking at how the crops might grow under current conditions and then into the future.
She said from her projections, climate change will impact crops differently.
In future, the coffee production areas for suitable for growing coffee are actually going to decline because it will be getting too warm for coffee growing. But in contrast, the production areas for growing cocoa might increase. The difference is because cocoa can't grow where it's too cool, all right? And so where those areas that are currently too cool are now actually warm up to the point where cocoa will become more suitable for growing.
Back in the Cook Islands, Silani Taeria said the conversation around climate change is shifting as growers are included in talks.
Our growers got to meet with a whole bunch of different people in the Cook Islands that are from private companies, NGOs, and from the government sector as well. And they actually got to work together to come up with solutions on how climate adaptation efforts can be better supported. Because previously, since they weren't included in the conversation, government would be coming up with solutions to these issues that farmers were not necessarily willing or even able to take on.
Farmers and the public and private sectors hope to implement solutions to enact change.
More frequent plantation visits at times that suits the growers' planting time, the installation of mini weather stations on each of the plantations, as well as more workshop scaling opportunities for the growers so they can learn more from others instead of them learning by trial and error on their own.
And that's Silani Taeria, Cook Islands Research Officer, ending that report from Lucy Cooper. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat, recapping our top story with a recent announcement by the Nauru government of $1 billion investment. A proposal signed with little-known Chinese company has set alarm bells ringing.
So we are no clearer about exactly what this company is or exactly what it does. And we're also no clearer about exactly what's being contemplated other than that statement that Nauru's government put out a few weeks ago.
And that's reporter Stephen Jedditz there. I'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time, and you can hear us again 5 p.m. PNG time this afternoon. Your news is next. Coming up after that is Sunita Daily. Until next time, o tō awhātou. You're listening into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.